Oh, hey, it's Glenn Gordon. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of MSDN Geek Speak. It's the interactive webcast series where we let you ask your questions of industry gurus and get them answered real time. So my co-host today on this episode of Geek Speak is Danny Diaz, a fellow developer evangelist up in the Philly area. So, Danny, how's the snow situation looking up there?
Yeah, it's not bad at all. You know, we have probably 30 inches altogether from accumulation from last week into today, so it's not bad at all.
So it's a good day to stay in and do a webcast?
It's a perfect day not only to do the webcast, but it's a perfect day to listen to a webcast, because I know a lot of developers are home today, so what a better way to keep up with technology than to take advantage of a off day to learn about these things.
Outstanding. So Danny and I spend a lot of our time with Microsoft, traveling to user groups, presenting there, speaking at other events around the country, and we run into a tremendous number of technology gurus in the community. And the Geek Speak series is an opportunity for us to bring those folks on to a live webcast and just pick their brains and talk about interesting technologies. And then also with all the folks who are attending live today, give them an opportunity to ask their questions and get them answered in real time. So we're going to encourage everybody to ask questions throughout the presentation today. We want to make it very interactive, and that's the format that we'll be following today. We're also going to be taking notes throughout the day, and if there are resources mentioned and videos to watch, we'll be collecting those all up and posting them to our Geek Speak blog. We've got links to the Geek Speak blog later on in the presentation, or you can just go to msdngeekspeak.com to find all the links that we have there. So, Danny, I think our guest today is from your neck of the woods, so why don't you introduce Dane and bring him on the show.
Yeah, so Dane has been, he's been a great asset to the local community here, and he's one of those developers who's really into data access and different ways to more efficiently access your data, which is, in essence, what we most developers, at least most business application developers, do, and he has a real passion around this topic, and has been doing some great presentations around the Philly area, different cool camps. I think he's traveled down even to somewhere south. I guess he'll tell us more about that. But I asked him to see if he could come into this program and give us a nice presentation today. He agreed to, so I'm definitely thankful for that opportunity that he's given us to pick his brain. So with that, Dane, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like Danny said, I'm a developer in the Philly area. I kind of traveled around a little bit. Started out in Michigan doing some work for a software company up there and ended up starting my own business for a few years. Moved down to Indianapolis, worked out of there for a couple of years, and then I moved out to Philly, and I've done, you know, all kinds of stuff from, you know, small software companies to, like right now, I'm doing advertising agency type stuff, you know, building some pretty cool websites and stuff for pharma companies. So I've been able to touch a lot of different things. And you know, one of the most interesting things that, you know, I've come across is just the way people do data access. So that's what really got me into Unity Framework in the first place.
Excellent. So you've been following Unity Framework since the beginning, right?
Yep. I started out doing using ORM tools all together when I was in Indianapolis. It's probably like four and a half years ago.
Okay.
And I fell in love with them. It was so easy to do data access code. I mean, I could very easily cut 75-80% of the time it would take me to write my data access layer, because I wouldn't have to go in and handcraft SQL statements, and, you know, especially if you have to make a change to your database, that can be a major pain to have to go through and change a whole bunch of different statements to accommodate that. And so I got introduced to ORM there, and I tried several of them. And then when Visual Studio 2008 came out, I saw like SQL. And at first, I really wasn't that impressed with Link. It didn't seem to me like it was going to be something that I would use very much. And I started using Link to SQL, and I'm like, this stuff is amazing. You know, especially what it would let you do with stored procedures and just the ease that you had in doing data access. And then when Service Pack 1 came out, and I saw Unity Framework, you know, I got really, you know, interested in it and jumped right on that. And pretty much switched almost completely to Unity Framework from Link to SQL at that point.
Yeah, that's probably good. Maybe we should spend a little bit of time on that, comparing them, because maybe a lot of listeners have tried Link to SQL and used it for its ease of use for getting the queries up and running, and maybe compare that a little bit to Unity Framework and talk about the direction things are going.
Okay. Well, it's kind of funny. I came across a blog post. I'll have to find it again so you guys can throw it up in my notes. But it was from one of the guys who actually built Link to SQL. And he was actually saying that Link to SQL was kind of a mistake because there was, you know, various versions of object data. I don't remember, actually can't remember. Object spaces is the ORM that came before it. And they were, the Link team was working on Link, and they, you know, said, well, we need to have something that we can showcase with Link, because Link on its own, while very cool, you know, won't necessarily bring people into it if they don't have something tangible they can do with it. So then he basically right. built a Link to Object Spaces, which worked so well, ended up shipping as Link to SQL. And then a whole entire separate team was working on Entity Framework. One of the real big differences between the two is Link to SQL is great if you've got a relatively small data structure where you don't need the you don't need anything real crazy, like the data structure has to follow the database exactly. So your model, your tables and your model have to match up to the tables in the database exactly. You can't really, you know, do any major tweaks there.
One example that I've seen of that is, like, let's say you had an employees table and you had a customers table and you had a many relationship. You have a third table that goes in the middle. That's still the case in Link to SQL, right? You have to sort of preserve that structure.
Yeah, you still have that table in Link to SQL. With Entity Framework, you won't have that table as long as the only thing that's in that table is the two keys. If you need to add anything else to that table, then you have to actually create a separate structure with its own primary key and its own identity field. And so, I mean, there's a few small gotchas like that because, you know, if you were just doing normal data access, you might just have a composite primary key. But, you know, it's, I think, a small price to pay for the advantages that you get from using an ORM. But one of the really cool things about Entity Framework is, you know, developers and DBAs tend to look at the database from a completely different perspective. You know, the database guy is going to look at the database, you know, as he wants it normalized a certain way. He wants the data built around the way the data is best stored and the way it's best indexed and things like that. The developer would rather have the database in a format that's easier to work with from code. And a lot of times, especially if you have a database guy who's not really done a lot of development, there's a disconnect there because your database, it's great for, you know, what it's got to store and stuff, but when you start going to add it from a development standpoint, it doesn't make as much sense to the developer when he's trying to work with objects. So the Entity Framework will allow you to make some tweaks and changes. You can do some composite entities, and because you can actually take that, if you wanted to, the employee table and the customer table and actually merge them together if you wanted to, you know, if you had some related data there. So not something I think a lot of people would do necessarily, but, you know, like I've seen tables where, you know, I'm sure we've probably all seen this at some point where you've inherited something and all the tables start with T underscore the table name, and then all the columns are a three-letter column with an underscore, and then there's, you know, what the column is, and then it has another three, you know, underscore, another three characters at the end to describe, you know, what it's going to, and the entire table's like that, no foreign keys, nothing. And
I've seen that a lot on tables that are imported from mainframe systems. It just preserves all that garbage, you know.
Yeah.
So what that gives us, Dean, what you're saying is with that, we can then concentrate on building our model first and not have to worry about what the, you know, back-end database looks like. Whereas in a Link to SQL, that's not supported. My model must match my structure. That's correct.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have to match. Some other, you know, I mean, obviously Link to SQL only works with SQL Server. Entity Framework works with SQL Server, SQL Server CE. There's a MySQL provider, which I actually got played with a little bit a few weeks ago, and I was pretty impressed at how well it works. Pretty much, if there is a data provider written for Entity Framework, then you can use Entity Framework with it. Whereas with Link to SQL, you are only stuck with SQL Server, which if you're only doing SQL Server development, that's not really that big of a deal. So.
Right. Going back to something you said a minute ago, with the difference between database, maybe DBAs setting up the storage in something that's optimized for storage and the developer wanting to work with a different way. What about the idea of reporting? Because I know a lot of the reporting tools are really geared towards the joins and relationships that are found in the database. Do you find that people that are working with an entity model, it's kind of jarring if they have to go back to the underlying data structure to do reporting?
Well, I think it really depends on the type of reporting you're going to be doing. If you're going to be doing any major reporting, chances are you're going to have a separate database anyway that's going to be optimized for reporting.
Okay.
Because, I mean, if you're dealing with something small, then your model's probably going to work okay. Like most of the little reporting that I do for websites that I've worked on, using any framework in those is fine because I just pull the objects and I can bind those and, you know, write in, say, like an active report or some other report render. But if you're doing anything major and crazy, chances are if you've got tons and tons of data, you're going to have one database that's going to be optimized for reads and updates, and you're going to have another database that is read-only that just gets stuff gets dumped into that's more optimized for reporting. So in that case, you know, in that case, you would probably, I haven't done anything like that in quite a while, but you probably use stored procedures to generate your reports from that point, probably bypass an ORM tool altogether.
Okay. Yeah, maybe using something like SQL Server Reporting Services. You'd build it with that, probably.
Right.
Okay. So in the context of the conversation today, we've given folks a little bit of a background on the Entity Framework and how it's used and how it's similar and different from Link to SQL. So let's talk specifically about this modification or this new capability in Entity Framework 4. And by the way, I think it's interesting that we're jumping from EF1 to EF4, kind of skipping the stuff in the middle. There's no significance to that other than wanting to keep the numbers in sync, right?
Yeah, well, the official word is that they're just syncing up the versions of .NET. I've heard other people come up with other reasons, but the official word is they're syncing the versions of the .NET. So.
Gotcha. Okay. So in the context of Entity Framework conversations we're having, what does it mean to have persistence ignorance, and what does that benefit bring in general to Entity Framework 4?
Well, what you have to look at first is, you know, persistence ignorance on its own, you know, what that really brings to the table. If you've got, especially if you're using any ORM tool, you know, chances are if you're building an application of any decent size, you're going to have multi-tiers. So you're going to have your presentation layer, you're going to have a business logic layer, and you're going to have a data layer. You know, you may have more or less, but if you're building a large application, I would definitely recommend having a separate data layer, if nothing else. And what that will give you is that gives you the ability to make changes to your data access layer without having to go through and change a bunch of code. So even if you're doing, you know, old ADO.NET and you're building, you know, you're crafting your SQL statements by hand, still having those in one spot makes a lot more sense. So what persistence ignorance really does is it allows you to have a data access layer that is completely independent of the database. So if you're using an ORM tool like Entity Framework, without the persistence ignorance features in there, or using Link to SQL, until you have that tied into an ASP.NET application. Your ASP.NET application, although you have a separate data layer, still has to know something about the back-end data store because you're passing back and forth Link to SQL objects or Entity Framework objects that are actually tied to the Entity Framework itself. So your ASP.NET database or ASP.NET application would actually have to have a reference to system.data.entity and things like that. So when you build a persistent ignorance layer, the classes that are used for interaction don't know anything about the database themselves. They're just plain old CLR objects or POCOs, as they're referred to. So you would have, like for instance, our couple demos today, we're going to have a person table, we're going to have an address table. With those as POCOs, those classes stand alone. You can take those and you can do whatever you wanted to them.
Can you explain what POCO is? Just so people, in case they might know what it is.
Okay, so a POCO is just—it's a plain old CLR object, is what it stands for, and basically it's an object that stands on its own. It doesn't inherit from anything. So if you go look at the class, which I'll show in a few minutes, you'll have, you know, you just have your class name and you have your properties and whatever you have on it, and there's no other inheritance, nothing else to it. It can literally be used anywhere.
So the advantage for a developer is they don't have to worry about inheriting from the right thing and implementing the right interfaces. They could just say, hey, I need a customer class, and it's going to have these properties, and then at some point in the future, I can wire everything up with the Entity Framework and have the data persisted.
Or even bring in dependencies either, because if, you know, if you're not inheriting from anything, then you know you don't have to install anything else or any third-party tool or anything like that.
Right.
And if you're doing something like test-driven, if you're doing something like test-driven development, I mean, that's crucial. Because a lot of times you will start, you know, you'll write your tests, you'll have your data structures, and you'll even maybe tie some of that into your UI, however you do it. But you need to be able to work with those classes as they are, but maybe not even push them out to a database yet. You're going to have another mock repository that's going to give you data because, you know, the way you work on the application may not be your database first. So it gives you that flexibility to build, you know, really any section you want first.
Very
and
cool.
Just makes unit testing all together a lot easier.
Right. We have a question from Bill. I think we'll go ahead and address that, and then maybe we can jump into some demos. But
okay.
Bill says, are there data patterns or techniques with Entity Framework that allow the end user of the application to easily extend the properties associated with a given entry, or entity, rather? For example, a food database with properties for fat, moisture, protein, et cetera, but the user wants to add other properties like calories or color. I guess I know what he does for a living, what industry he's in. So is it sort of extensible for user-generated data persisting alongside the other things in the entity?
You should be able to do that. That's not something I've actually personally tried. But because they are POCO objects, I believe the Entity Framework is only going to look at the properties on the class that it actually needs. So you can put in your own methods, you can put in your own properties. Now, just keep in mind that those extra properties you add will not get persisted to the database.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So.
Okay, good. So do you have a couple of demos to show this in action?
Yeah. Yeah, so I've got several here.
Just setting that up, I just want to remind everyone to use the questions tool to ask any questions that you might want Dane to answer for you today.
All right. Okay, so what I've got here is just a basic console application.
Now you're running inside of, you're running Visual Studio 2010, right?
Yes, I'm actually running the RC.
It just came out.
Yeah, it came out Monday. I picked it up. I was a little leery because I knew it's just coming up, but I figured I'd go ahead and take the risk, and if I have to, I'll blow it away and put Beta 2 back on. A couple of interesting things from that I'll actually show you. There's one issue you'll have to go around if you're using the POCO templates, and we'll get to that in just a second. The first thing we want to do, best we're starting out with a basic console application. For those of you not familiar with any framework at all, basically what you want to do is you want to add the ADO.NET entity model. Yeah, let's try this. All right. And you've got a couple options here. You can generate from database. You can do an empty model. If you want to do model first development, you can start with an empty model. We're going to go ahead and start with a database. Demos.
In most projects that people are going to be using Entity Framework for, do you anticipate most people just saying, well, I've got a database that's a reasonable approximation of my model structure, so I'll just pull that in? Or do you think people are going to start from scratch and create a super clean model and then figure out how to link it?
Well, if you already have a database, I would recommend starting with your database and creating a model from it. For new applications, the modeling tools work very well. I actually, since Beta 2 came out, I've been using the modeling tools within it for any new project that I've got, and it works very well. So
yeah, no, a lot of the projects that I've done in the past on consulting engagements, we would do an Irwin diagram, and it would take up three walls of a cubicle, and then we'd sit down and implement that, and then we'd start talking about UI on top of it. It looks like this approach now, you can create the model without ever having to actually go into the database yet and sort of explore the model and work with it.
Yeah, well, you do have to generate a database from the model. There has to be, because an EDMX file, which is your Entity Framework files, has three parts to it. It has the conceptual model, which is the model you work with. It has the physical model, which is the actual SQL model, and then it has a mapping model in between. All three of those have to be present for you to work with Entity Framework, but for you to work with the context. Go ahead and I'll show you that file in just a second. Let's go ahead and we're going to leave this. Just a quick note, pay real close attention to what you're putting in here is the connection string settings, because this is actually the class name that you'll be using, your context. I know some, like we have databases at work that have a prefix to them with the client, and I always have to go and take those out, so just to remember that. Alright, so it's going to pop up here, and like I said, we've got two tables. We've got an address and a person. We're going to go ahead and select both of them. The model namespace here is going to stay the same. Now, here's another big difference between EF1 and EF4 is in EF1 you didn't have access to foreign keys, and EF4 you do, which is another huge feature. And then you can also automatically singleize or pluralize the object names. So in this case, we have person, so it'll end up being the table, or the model will say people, and address will be addresses and such. And if you're interested in all the new features, the PDC demo actually shows quite a bit of the new stuff, so I recommend checking that out. Okay.
We'll get a link to that video up on our site.
Okay. The model browser over here has some kind of cool information, but I don't usually use it that much. We're going to go ahead and just close that out. So here we have, it didn't change it. I must have one other where it did. It kept this person. So we have a person table, we have an address table. The person has first name, last name, date of birth, you know, address, has basic things you can get off of an address. If you look at the properties on each of those, when you click into them, it'll tell you what the max length is. So if it's, you know, like a bar char and in bar char, you've got your length there. It'll tell you what the actual database, the name is called. Whether or not you're getter, you can set getters and setters to public. It's kind of cool. If you're doing model first, though, one thing you definitely have to make sure of is that you set this store generated pattern to identity, because if you don't, it will just be a primary key, and it won't actually be an identity, so you have to just set that. So there's a lot of cool stuff you can do here. Really, the only things you can't set, like, check constraints and some other more deeper areas of your database. So if you're doing modeling, you'll have to watch out for that. But now that we have this in our project, you'll see here we have an EDMX file. If you were to open this up, it's basically a big XML file that describes all of your mappings. The CS file here is generated. Now, if you notice, it only generates one file. A lot of ORM tools actually will generate one or multiple files for each table, so everything is in this one file. If you have a huge model of stocking, you're pretty big, so you might want to separate it up into separate models.
That has to do with what you're doing now. This question is coming from Jim. He basically wants to know how much overhead is being added by Microsoft to the classes.
Okay, these classes here, they're fairly lightweight, the actual classes themselves. So let's go in and look at, like, here, let's get the person class. So in the person class, inside the primitive methods, we've got, it basically has, you know, the person ID. It has some stuff for each one, and it's got some things in here to determine what's changed. So whenever you set it, it fires off a bunch of properties to go in and set on change. So this is for the entity framework to know that, hey, this information has actually changed. So when you go to save it, it only saves what it needs to. So, I mean, there is a little bit of overhead, but not an extreme amount. It's mostly just setting booleans, and it'll set an alternate value, or the original and current values. So if you go and change it, it'll actually store the old ones so that it knows what they are.
So this is something that's easy for you to go in and kind of check it out, see what's going on behind the scenes, nothing to be
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, you can certainly, you can open up this file. I didn't make any changes to it, but you can open this up and take a look at it and see what it's doing. You know, if you notice, if you look back in here, everything inherits from entity object. So, you know, this as it is right now is not ignorant at all of the database. These classes are very, very strongly tied into the entity framework. Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were writing an app that consumed those, you wouldn't be necessarily interested in all that. You would still refer to person and entity types. You don't have to know that they're wired differently internally, right?
Right. I mean, and you don't even, I mean, if you were doing, say, a WPF app that was all self-enclosed and it had its own data access, you really wouldn't have any real need at that point to do persistence ignorance, because it's not going to gain you a whole lot in a small self-contained structure.
Gotcha. Okay.
So what we'll go ahead and do is just go ahead and throw in a real quick all right. So what I'm doing here is I'm just spinning up a real quick
looks like you've got a list coming up there with
So I'm spinning up a quick list.
By the data.
Now, another thing I want to point out for those of you new to Entity Framework is when you make an Entity Framework call, it's going to spit back an iQueryable as a collection, and every time you hit that collection, it's going to go back to the database. So you want to get pushed out to a list or something as fast as you can, so that you don't actually run up against that.
Going back to that generated, code that gets generated, how much of that is based on link? Is there a lot of link going on behind the scenes there, or is it just straight up code?
In the classes that are generated, it's pretty much straight up code. There's other link magic that happens inside the context, and there's probably some stuff that happens inside the actual entity object classes themselves with the generated stuff is pretty much just straight up with those extra properties on there to show what's been changed and whatnot.
Okay.
All right. So well,
more commonly, you'd be using link to go against the objects that are created with the Entity Framework.
Exactly. And like here, I'm using a it's not really a lambda, but you'd end up doing a lambda if you wanted to do like a where on it. If you wanted to express this on link, you could just do people equals. And both of these statements would actually return the same result. Now, the difference here is if you use this, if this was just a var, and this would actually return an iQueryable, so you have to surround this with a to list. So if you're pulling a basic thing, the lambda style, you know, inline is really a lot easier to work with. let's just go ahead and now one of the really cool things I love about the for each. One of the things I really like about Entity Framework and Link to SQL is the fact that everything's strongly typed. And you have a cell sense for everything. So people is a collection of person, and then off of person, you see here I have access to all the properties. Now you notice there's an entity key and an entity state. Those are all, those come from the actual entity object itself. So let's go ahead and write a first thing out to the console. And if we go ahead and run this.
So you're saying at the point where the to list is encountered, that's when it actually does the retrieval.
That's when it actually hits the database. So you see I've got myself and Danny in the database here as people. So it spits out our names. And really I'm showing you this to show you that, you know, that it does work as is. So that when I go do some cool T4 magic, I'll be able to show you that it still works. So as it is now, the classes that we're using are tied to the Entity Framework. Now, to make this persistent ignorant, there's really three ways to do it. You can use create POPO classes using the T4 templates, which is what I'm about to show. You can do it without T4 templates where you craft your context and your classes by hand, and then you can do code only where you do everything in code.
Right.
And each has its advantages based on what you're wanting to do. So what we do here is go back to the model, right-click on the model, and then there's add code generation item. And it's going to be over in code. If you download they released a new POCO class that works with Beta 2 about a week and a half ago. To get that to work with the RC, you have to do a couple small things, which Julie Lerman, who wrote Programming Entity Framework for O'Reilly, has a really good blog post on, and I'll actually show you how to make the change here. So I usually try to name this the same thing. So that my T4 template is named the same as my context, just to keep it the same, so I group together.
So what this does? What does that mean?
Oh yeah, I don't remember off the top of my head what T4 stands for, but it's a code generation system within Visual Studio.
Oh.
It's what actually produces this file here, which is now blank. That's where all anytime you have something that generates code within Visual Studio, it comes from a T4 template somewhere. And what's cool about it is you can modify them. Now, if you'll notice, as soon as I get this, as soon as I put this in there, I've got an error. And this is because the Beta 2 template does not work with RC yet. So all I have to do is there's an include file, which I know the Entity Framework team is working on getting a new version of this out. But there's an include file here. This one is actually the offending file here. So I've got another one called with a B2 in it, and that's actually the old one from Beta 2. And so we'll go ahead and build this. Again, why is it working?
So to remind folks that we're going to be getting links to the blog post that Dane mentioned about doing this change. We'll link all that on our GeekSpeak blog, and that address again is blogs.msdn.com/GeekSpeak.
Okay, so what I've got is I had to work, forgot how to do it in both templates. And basically, if you take a quick look at the T4 template, it's actually kind of cool. You get this code coloring. There's another add-on that you can get that allows you to edit the T4 template. But it basically, this is what it takes and generates the code. It takes the EDMX file and then generates your code off of those templates.
It's almost like a mail merge.
Yeah. So now what I've got is there's two templates created. There's one for the contacts and one for the entities themselves. So if we look into the context one real quick, it's got some constructors. It's got some properties. Lazy loading is a new feature coming in EF. It's within EF4. It's not one that I actually use a lot, but it has its uses. But it's available if that's one of the pain points that people didn't like about EF1. And then this is where it sets the what actually objects are within that. And I'll go into this in a little bit more detail with the next demo. So we're going to talk about how to craft these from hand. And the other ones will fly through those. I just want to show you what gets created here. So in these templates, they're still POCOs. They don't actually come from anything else. Yeah. Now they are partials because they've got this entities itself here has some other information. This has a collection that has to go with it. It allows some things to work with the POCOs a little bit differently. I actually kind of wish this template was a little bit more stripped down. You can actually go on and modify it if you want it to strip it down. You'll notice here everything is virtual, which you'll have some issues with this if you try to do anything crazy with WCF using the POCO. So that's why I normally like to do the handcrafted for things like that. But, all in all, you see here there's really nothing crazy in these. They're straight up classes. They have these fix-up collections, but there's nothing in any framework in here. It's not using anything. These are straight up POCO classes. So if I go in, and obviously it still builds, so it still reads everything, and if I run it again, it still pulls the data just fine. You'll still be able to do all your updates, all your inserts, everything using POCO. And if you just want basic POCO support and you're not, especially if you're not doing anything against like WCF, then this template is wonderful. It works great. It allows you to get started with it very easy. So that's really the first one. Second demo.
Now I noticed here, when you added those elements, when you added those things to the project, it basically took them out of the EDMX completely,
right,
and just gave you new files. Cool.
Yeah, well, because there's because basically the EDMX file, which if I'm not sure what's going to, I can open it with text editor. This is what the EDMX file is. So the code generation reads this file. This has all of your information on what is actually in the database and what's in your conceptual model. And if you use the standard generation, your classes will show up in the designer.cs. Since we're not using those, we use the template. So let's move on real quick. I've got a couple other demos here. Got some MVC demos here. I love ASP.NET MVC, and that's one of the areas where I really like to use persistence, ignorance, and POCO classes. So I've got a basic, I've got two views here with two actions of people and people address. Now if you'll look here, if you just pay attention to the first two projects in here, I'm using the T4 templates inside a data layer, inside a separate assembly. And if we look at the references on the MVC app, you won't see system.data.entity anywhere because it's not required. If we go over and look at the home controller, basically what I do is I've got my model is just a list of person. All the views are strongly typed, and they just pull back. I've got one that pulls back get people and one that pulls back get people with address. If we look at the admin class, and I'm actually using these same classes across all three demos, all it does is it spins up a new context. It pushes out to people. Now, what you'll notice here on get people with address is I've got a dot include. One of the new features in EF4 is lazy loading. Well, lazy loading only works while you're still inside your context. As soon as you disconnect from your context, you're gone from the database because the context includes your connection, all your readers, all your command objects. So in order for me to get the addresses included into these people, I have to do an include here, which is something I would definitely recommend doing. Lazy loading has its uses, but for the most part, it can get in your way. And if you're doing MVC, the way MVC works, even if you do your your context inside your model or inside your controller, as soon as you pass that model down to your view, it's disconnected from the database. So lazy loading won't work at that point. So if we go ahead and run this, go ahead and set a couple of breakpoints here. Watch what it's open. Something here. All right, so I've just got a real basic thing to see at with people.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's going to do is it's going to call my persistent function to go in the model. And I see here it actually creates proxy clauses. You can turn that off so that they're truer POCO clauses, but they're not actually tied to any framework, but the way it comes across, they come across as proxies. But you see here we don't have any of the entity keys or anything here. You know, the person ID is there. And if we go ahead and pass that on, you'll see there that there's the data. So now if I hit people with addresses and look at the same thing, I know that the second one has an address. And so I go into addresses, and I see here that there is one, and I get, you know, dig deeper into that and see the actual address. And if you go on, boom, it's there. Now, if you're just doing straight up MVC and, you know, you don't need anything, you know, you're not going to be serializing data out to XML or doing anything crazy, you're just trying to display data, then the T4 templates are awesome. You're going to run into problems, though, if you need to serialize data. I'm having a little bit of trouble with the T4 templates, hopefully. I mean, it is beta software, so it is beta, so hopefully it'll get fixed before the final release.
Right.
But, and I love REST, and I think WCF is usually a good place to do REST, especially if you've got an application along with it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go ahead and let's look at this first one here. Actually, let me show you the project first. Let me jump into it. Show you what's in it. So in this one, you see here, now this one does have a system.data.data entity because we're not going to share REST with POCO. You can still use Entity Framework objects within MVC or WCF or any of those. You'll have to have that connection to the Entity Framework. So if we go into the home controller, you'll see here it's pretty much the same thing. I have an attribute that just spits the data out as XML versus actually creating a view.
Okay.
And in the data library here, we see there's no persistent signature. So I've got here a REST demo and then a REST demo of POCO, so I can show you what the real difference is when you start pushing data down. Okay, so the first one here, we've got people XML, which is going to give us an XML serialized version of those objects. Now, if you look here, for two objects with a little bit of data, I mean, it's not SOAP, it is REST. So I mean, but even as REST, there's still a lot of data here. You've got this entire entity key structure, which actually takes up more bandwidth than all your data combined. And for smaller classes, that's absolutely going to be the case. I mean, if you have larger classes, you may have quite a bit more data. But still, that's a lot of data going over the pipe, you know, especially if you have a large amount of classes coming across.
Mm-hmm. So it's not as bad as it could be.
Yeah, it's not as bad as it could be, but it's still not ideal. So if we go over to the data library on the second one, you'll see here that I've created my own POCO context, which this is how you craft them from hand. You basically just have a context that derives from the object context. And the context is always going to be tied to the new framework, but the classes it uses aren't necessarily. So this context has its constructor. I set lazy out, you know, lazy loading, enabled equals true. These two have to be here, the connection string container name. These are what you call the EDMX file. And it actually still does use the EDMX file. It still has to be there for the model. And then we just go in and add the classes. And this is basically the same stuff that was in the generated template. It's just stripped down. So it has only what you absolutely need. Same thing with the addresses in person. Now we look at these, and these are very stripped down. They're just basic properties with the data fields. Now the properties have to match up to the column names in your model, but not necessarily, obviously, in your database, because your model and your database can be different, but the POCO classes have to match your model. So you can put, you know, as long as you've got your columns in there that match, if you leave one out, you're gonna run into problems. But it does allow you to work with them Yeah,
so that's pretty interesting that you just have a public list of type address, and it figures out the one-to-many relationship in the database, and then that makes it a collection.
And where this comes from is if we jump over to our model real quick, you'll see that these navigation properties, we have one off of person for addresses. So it knows that addresses is a bunch of addresses. So it has to match up to these. So if I went in and I changed this, you know, to address, it's not going to work. It has to actually match the model exactly.
And that's going back to the point that you made earlier about not needing that link table there when you have a many-to-many relationship.
Mm-hmm.
SQL, link to SQL, you do need that, but with VF, you don't. That table goes away, or at least that object goes away.
The table's still there, but in the model, it's actually inferred. So what I would have with a many-to-many, if I had a many-to-many between person and address, what I would have on address is I would have a list of persons, a person called people, is the way it works. And you wouldn't, in the model, you wouldn't even see that third table.
Exactly.
So what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to spin up both of these again. Now, when you're doing the handcrafted COCOs with the model, there's one gotcha you got to watch out for, and that's you're going to have some ambiguous table names between the two because they're going to be identical. So you see here I've got data.poco. Another way around that would be to do the T4 generation and then just delete the T4 templates. And that's what I usually do because you don't even have to worry about it. That's good. I don't know why that's not here. Let's kick off the second one. All right, so we're going to run this, and this is with our POCO, and if you look at the XML generated from here, it's much smaller.
Sure.
So if we put these two side by side, you can see the difference in the amount of data that's actually going across the wire between these two.
What would be the different types of applications that would want the data with the more explicit entity markup versus the plain one? Is there a case where you'd have an application like that?
I really don't think that. There's probably some edge cases that would need it. All in all, if you're going to be exposing data via REST, then mm-hmm. you're probably going to have everything inside those that you need. And so the actual entity containers themselves won't really help the end application. There's also another system you can use called self-tracking entities, which passes in a little bit more information, which allows the classes to actually be tracked on their own, which I'm not going to get into that because I'm going to have a little trouble with those templates as well. Once again, hopefully when we final release, everything will work fine there. Go ahead.
I'm saying on the last example that you showed, if you put a breakpoint, would you still have the proxy information there?
Okay, yeah, I can actually show that, because you actually won't. And it makes it much, much cleaner.
So it seems like with the amount of work that you're willing to invest, you can either have lots of entity stuff in your classes, a little bit or nothing.
Right. Okay, so if we look at now, if we look at our model, right off the bat, you can see that it's clean classes. You go in here and it's only what you need, and you see addresses and all.
Much better, obviously.
Yeah, everything. It definitely serializes much better. Everything works a lot better. There's a lot less data going across the pipe, a lot less memory being consumed by your application. Which for small applications, really, the size of computers these days isn't that big a deal, but when we start getting into larger applications, it can certainly become a big deal. So, last real quick one we'll show is a WCF application, where what I've got here is I've once again created my own POCO contexts. I've been having some trouble with WCF, anything outside of handcrafted POCOs with EF. And I know that the team's working on it. I'm not sure where the actual problem is. So if you're going to be doing a lot with WCF, I would recommend doing your handcrafted POCOs. But if you see here, I've got a class that just calls get people, and it passes it out to a service. and then I've got a consuming, just a console app, which it just called it. So if I go ahead and spin up, and that's there. And one of these watch windows decided to show up on this. First time I've ever seen this do it to me. Even running through these earlier today, I didn't see this. So I don't know what I did, but it's, something happened. Okay, so if we kick off this class here, so you see it went through our service, got everything right. We hit this application. You see here we had the same thing. Bubble classes, very small. And this is the actual WCF classes, the proxies that are generated by WCF. So, and I mean, and that's, I believe that's, this is all still being transferred via SOAP, but if you set that up as TCP or however you want to do it, you can really have a lot tighter control over the data going over the wire and still be able to take advantage of things like persistent signatures for the POCO classes.
Gotcha.
And what's cool about POCO is you can still do lazy loading, and you can still do all the other cool things that you can do with it, except the classes that you're actually working with are not tied directly to any framework. So,
mm-hmm. Very interesting. Hey, so, Dan, we've got a couple of questions in the queue.
Yeah.
Jim says, many of us are adding error handling in our model.
Okay.
How's that added in the entity framework? And I think that also is useful to talk about where it would fit in with the POCO classes versus the full classes generated by the tool.
Okay. If you want to do that, I would definitely say you'd want to go POCO, because what you can do is you could actually just, you could flush out the, say you wanted a first name, you wanted to check, on set, see if it was, check maybe a regular expression or just make sure it's not, blank or something. You can set that right inside the property. And the cool thing is because it's property, any framework uses it and just sets it. And then you can set in all your error handling, anything you want to do inside that, right inside there.
Okay. So that sort of thing, that's a POCO issue. Any class that you write, you can put some validation on it. But once the class receives it and it's valid, then that's going to notify, for lack of a better word, the entity framework surroundings.
Right. And you could also, even if you wanted to, if you had
value, right?
Right. And if you wanted to have, say, you had a class that you inherited from that had a base class that did some validation and, maybe used reflection or whatever to check properties, you could actually just inherit that your POCO classes from any other class. Because as long as everything matches up, as long as it all matches up, you're good. You're gonna start running into problems though, as long as you if you change a property name or something. As long as everything is there and it matches up, then it'll use that class.
Okay. Then there's a question from Bill. He says, I ran into a problem with Visual Studio 2010 RC creating an EF project but was using Team Foundation server. And some of the files that were auto-generated got kind of confused the source control. Have you seen anything like that where some of the files generated with the tools are having problems with being stored in the code repository?
I have not seen any problems with it personally. I don't use Team Foundation Server, so I've never tried it through there, so it's very possible. I've seen issues with other ORMs with source control, especially if you've got more than one person working on the model.
Interesting.
What I would recommend is that you have one person, if possible, in charge of your model. Because, I was at a couple of jobs I was at in Indianapolis. That was one of the things as a lead developer that was my job. I was in charge of the database structure and the ORM tools. So that if somebody needed something changed, it wasn't a big deal. They just come to me. That way there was one central point. There was one person checking it in the source. There was one person that was in charge of that. So that alone would alleviate 99% of the issues. So.
Another question that we have from Mike is, can you comment on the performance implications of using the full EF implementation versus the POCO implementation?
I have not done any real performance tests. I haven't seen any performance differences. I would almost tend to think that it would probably be less, that the POCO would actually perform better, just because there's less with the classes, there's less memory overhead, there's less that has to get passed around in memory. So without doing any actual tests, I would say the POCO would probably perform a little better.
Okay.
Another question here from Caleb. lazy loading is now supported. Excuse me, lazy loading is now supported for Apache classes only. Would that be correct?
Well, lazy loading in EF4 is supported for any classes that you use within the Unity framework. But I mean, you're obviously not going to use it once you disconnect it from the context. It won't work. So as long as you're still inside the context, lazy loading will work with the regular Unity framework objects. It'll work with POCO objects. It'll work both the same.
Interesting.
Okay. And there's a question from Ed. He's wanting to know if you've heard of proposed changes that would allow you to build an entity model from classes themselves and not just a database.
That I'm not aware of. So there still has to be that the physical data structure. You can do the code-only development, which will alleviate you from having to use the actual EDMX file, but it still actually creates the model on the fly.
Right.
I'm not aware of anything that would allow you to... I mean, I guess technically, if someone wrote a provider, you could have an Unity framework against like an in-memory database, but you'd have to have a provider for that.
Yeah. I'm thinking he's not meaning the persistent store. I think he's saying I can build a model from classes and then turn around and push that into a database as if I was building a model from scratch. But I haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not aware of that. You know, I actually couldn't think of that. I think there might be an option. Don't take me, take my word on this for sure, but I think there might be an option inside the code only to do that. There's a method, I believe there might be a method call that might do that, but that wouldn't hold me to that.
Okay.
If you want features in, though, I saw on Twitter this morning that the team has got a new Connect site set up for EF to allow people to submit features and vote on features. So if you're using EF and you want to get some features in there, I would definitely check that site out and submit anything that you might want.
So Dan, let's say I'm a developer who's who's been doing things the old way, the old data sets using ADL.NET, and I want to move into doing it, doing my data access using EF or even Link to SQL for that matter. What do you recommend? What would be my steps? What should I do as a developer to kind of get started with stuff? Is it just picking up, and just start building an application, or are there any like good resources that help you get up to speed with these things?
Well, I mean, as far as getting up to speed with EF, I mean, there's lots of blogs and stuff out there. But if you're wanting to convert your application, then I mean, really the best way to do it would just be create your model, get your code in there, and start working away, because I mean the two will stand side by side. I mean, there's actually been instances where I have needed to actually drop back down to a straight ADO connection because I had one query that just, some link is great, but it doesn't work in 100% of the cases. And so I actually had to go through and write some ADO.NET code. So the two can coexist. But another thing too is if you've built a data structure so that you have that separated data layer, then you can go back and just change that data layer and be able to upgrade your code that way. I mean, that's, it really depends on how you've architected the application from the beginning, how you want to do it.
Right. Makes sense. Well, Dane, we are almost out of time. Are there any sort of last-minute tips or guidance that you want to give us?
Well, really, if you haven't looked at EF, EF4 is definitely much better, and it's an awesome tool. I've used a lot of the other ARM tools, including Hibernate, which is the big one. And I would just recommend people checking it out, taking a look at it. I have a couple things on my blog, but I would definitely look at the ADO.NET team blog. Julie Lerman's blog, the datafarm.net, has a lot of good things. Just keep looking online. Just if you get stuck, don't hesitate to even hit me up on Twitter. People, almost every day that ask me small EF questions on Twitter all the time. So, just don't get there.
The 40 character limit keeps people from rambling, doesn't it?
Well, what usually happens is we'll take it off of Twitter and go into IM or something like that. But it's one of those technologies you're jumping into. You might get stuck on something. So don't scrap it just because you get stuck. Feel free to ask. Everybody asks.
We have one more question here.
Actually, Danny, let's get to that in a moment. I've got a slide up here that's got links to the GeekSpeak blog where you can get follow-up resources in a few days. We'll be posting some of the links that were mentioned, as well as see our upcoming shows. We've got a couple of more Geek Speaks coming up over the course of February and March, so we hope people tune into that. And you can check out my blog and Danny's blog, and then, Dane, we have your blog listed here as well. And then we're going to also turn it over for a minute to our moderator to get the survey started, and then we'll take that last couple of questions in the queue.
Thank you very much. I'd like to remind everyone that you may print a PDF of the slides by clicking Control P. You can either print or save the slides locally for your convenience. You should now be seeing the survey slide in your area. If you could take a moment to fill it out before you log off today, we would appreciate any feedback you leave for us. All you need to do is follow the links provided to complete the evaluation. With that, I'll hand the floor back over to our presenters to wrap up any questions.
Great. Thanks. And, yeah, we definitely appreciate the feedback you give us. It helps us make sure the Geek Speaks are meeting your needs in the future. So, Danny, go ahead with Mike's question if you want to.
Sure. So his question is, you know, if data access performance is critical, should entity framework 4 be avoided in favor of a more traditional approach of calling store procedures through ADO.NET?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really depends on, you know, how vital that performance is. I mean, obviously, anytime you add a layer to something, you're going to be creating, you know, extra overhead. So if you have to have, you know, absolutely best performance as possible, then ORM tools altogether are probably out of the question. Now, what's nice is you can usually use a mix. So you can use, you know, if you have to, you can use any framework for some of your basic CRUD operations for those things that aren't necessarily as performance specific, and then you can have stored procedures for the things that are. Now, the nice thing about EF4 is you can actually call those stored procedures from within any framework.
The other thing to consider, Dane, also, is that one of the nicest things about using Link is that when you use Link, your code, the code that gets generated behind the scenes, I guess the code that goes to the bytecode that gets generated from the CLR, can be optimized at runtime. Whereas if you know regular, well, I guess all .NET code gets optimized, but Link code even more gets optimized even more. So that's the advantage of using.
Yeah, and the IL would, but the SQL might not necessarily.
Well, definitely not. But you can always just call your regular store procedures from the framework.
Right.
So that doesn't become. And the other thing too is that as parallelism becomes more prevalent, and you want to take advantage of that, it's easier for you to take advantage of multi-core using something like Parallel Link.
Once you already have
an EF, you know, layer.
Right.
That's true. Huge benefit there. Excellent. Well, there's no more questions in the queue, and we're right at the top of the hour. So thanks very much for Dane to come on the Geek Speak and share with us cool information about any framework.
So I just want to shout out one real quick thing before we're done.
All right.
I have a podcast that I'm doing with Andrew Duffy, the developer evangelist out of Virginia. It's the Community Megaphone podcast. It's just new. We just launched our third show today. So if you haven't seen it, go out to communitymegaphonepodcast.com and check it out.
Great. Thanks. And Danny, thanks for being a co-host today, and I hope you guys survived the snow up there.
I hope so, too.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for coming.
Care,